This is Mark Guggenheim. You are listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Comic book lovers, superhero fans, all those out there knowledgeable about everything that is cool on this planet, welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. You are here for the penultimate year 5 episode of Comic Book Central. You're in the right place. You are in the right time. That's right. The 5th anniversary special, it's right around the corner. Wrapping things up today with one amazing guest. You regular listeners, you have already heard from him right here on the show. Episode 238, to be precise. That was my trip to Terrificon. The co-creator of Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow, Mark Guggenheim. He is my guest today here in the lair. Yeah, we met up at Terrificon this summer. We chatted about some of his comic book writing, talked a little bit about Arrow, and we made arrangements to sit down for an in-depth chat. That happens today. Can't think of a better guest to bring year 5 of the show to a close before that epic 5th anniversary recap of the past year of Comic Book Central. Mark Guggenheim, he's going to be here in just a few moments. Arrow talk, the other green-themed DC superhero, Green Lantern. We're going to be talking about Hal Jordan as well and some surprises headed your way. We're going to be talking about a lot today. That conversation headed your way in just a few minutes. Before I sit down with Mark, though, a quick reminder. The Comic Book Central 5th anniversary special, that airs November 10th. As I mentioned, it's right around the corner. As you know, each and every anniversary special, I've got an anniversary present for one of you amazing listeners out there. That's right. It's my anniversary, but you're getting the gift. What's this year's giveaway? Oh, man, just one of the most amazing Superman the movie prints you'll ever lay your eyes on. Now, if you've been following the show on social media, facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork, Twitter at comicbookctrl, then you have seen the glory of artist John Pinto's 40th anniversary Superman the movie print. I've pinned it to the top of both of those social media pages so you can lay your eyes on that right there. Exclusive to Comic Book Central. It is one of one. I do not have it. I will never have it. It is for one of you folks out there. You are going to get a one-of-a-kind exclusive. How do you get your hands on it? Man, it's simple. Drop me a line, joe@comicbookcentral.net, or you can record an MP3 and send that along, or you can record a voicemail message at my website, comicbookcentral.net. Tell me your favorite moment from year 5 of the show. That's episodes 201 through this episode right now that you are listening to. You do that, I'll revisit that moment on my anniversary special, and then you are in the running to get that super print from artist John Pinto. It is Christopher Reeve in a Superman issue 1 pose. He's got the cast of the film surrounding him. It's signed by the artist, and it could be yours. But hurry. The deadline to email me or to record a voicemail and send that along to me is November 5th. Got to give me some time to put the show together, right? Some of you out there have already done that. You've sent them in. You've sent in your moments. You've recorded MP3s. My thanks. I'm going to be playing that all on the show. I'm going to be reading those emails on the show. The rest of you, don't sleep on this one. Trust me, you want this print, man. It is amazing. And I want to hear from you. And if you want to check out John's other artwork, it is stellar. Don't forget to check out the website, johnpinto.com. It is johnpinto.com. Check it out. Will your favorite moment be from today's show? There is a very good chance of that happening because he is one of my favorite guests. We're going to be talking about a lot of my favorite stuff today. Hang tight, check this out, and then you will hear from the showrunner of Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow, Mark Guggenheim. Now, we know Mark from his stellar writing in the world of comic books for such characters as Aquaman, Wolverine, The Flash, The Punisher, Spider-Man, and he's written for X-Men Gold most recently. Amazing series there. As well as his writing on Arrow and Legends of Tomorrow and his showrunning and producing capabilities on those shows. But his fascination with law and order and justice, that manifested itself in an early career as a lawyer. Now, soon enough, though, he got the writing bug and he went to Hollywood, where he worked on classic legal series like The Practice, Law and Order, CSI Miami, and Injustice, among many other TV series. In 2004, he joined forces with writer-producer Greg Berlanti on the WB drama Jack and Bobby, and that was a super team-up that we fanboys and fangirls could appreciate. They went on to work on the Fantastic Four-esque series No Ordinary Family, and in 2011, they brought Green Lantern to the big screen, starring Ryan Reynolds. Now, while both projects fell a bit short of expectations, they did serve to open the door to a much bigger superhero universe. It is what is now known affectionately as the Berlantiverse. Right now, we've got The Flash, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, Black Lightning, Riverdale, more comic book themed shows on the way, but it all started in 2012 with Arrow.
For 5 years, I've had only one thought: survive.
Oliver Queen is alive.
I am returning. Not the boy who was shipwrecked, but the man who will bring justice to those who have poisoned my city. Those who rule through intimidation and fear. Every last one of them will wish I had died on that island.
He was wearing a hood, a green hood.
And he had a bow and arrow.
We'll put out APB on Robin Hood.
Did your father survive that accident? Did he tell you anything?
He told me I'm gonna kill you.
All units converge!
It looks like Starling City has a guardian angel.
Tell me you saw that.
Nobody can know my secret.
And for 6 seasons of the mega-hit superhero CW show, Mark served as showrunner, even writing some of the series' most memorable episodes. In 2016, he and Berlanti co-created the spin-off superhero series Legends of Tomorrow, where Mark also served as showrunner, running back and forth from Arrow to Legends and keeping the mythology together. In 2017, Mark won an Emmy Award for his writing on Trollhunters: Tales of Arcadia, a computer-animated fantasy Netflix series created by Guillermo del Toro. Now, time to welcome back to the show an Emmy-winning writer-producer. He has also written comic book tales of some of our favorite characters for both page and screen, and he is one of the masterminds behind the Arrowverse on the CW. Hey, kids! Mark Guggenheim is back on the show. Mark, welcome back to Comic Book Central.
Hey, thanks for having me. That's the best introduction I've ever gotten.
Oh, wow. Okay, I'll take that.
First of all, I've never been the word mastermind has never been used in connection with me. Number one. Number two, this is the first time that I've heard the name Emmy Award winner used.
Get used to it.
Yeah, it's probably kind of cool.
Get used to it. Yeah, it's.
Yeah, I hope I don't get used to it. I hope it never gets old.
The luster. Yeah, I've won in Mid-South Emmys, so it doesn't get old. I've won regional Emmys, so it's always fun. But it's so much fun to be recognized by your peers. I think that's the important part of this is you put all that work in, and we'll talk about all the work you've done. But just to know that it was acknowledged on some level by your peers, and it's like, you know what, you did a good job on this. That's the fulfilling part.
Thanks. It was incredibly, incredibly fulfilling. And, everyone works so hard on the shows. I really did feel like when I got that award, I was accepting it not just for myself, but for not the entire writing staff, but also everyone involved with Trollhunters, right? Because it really is a team sport, you know?
Yeah. You never do these things in a vacuum, but it's the producer gets a credit, the writer gets a credit. But yeah, you never do these things in a vacuum. There's always a lot of people behind it. And you've surrounded yourself with a lot of talented folks. Hey, by the way, so glad I got a chance to meet you at Terrificon. That was fun.
That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that convention. It was great meeting you. That was a blast.
Yeah. It's okay. So when you're at these things, I don't know how many of them you do during the year, but like, do you get more comic book questions for your writing, or do you get like the live action stuff, or is it a pretty healthy surf and turf combo?
That's a great question. It really depends. I would say that the answer really varies depending on the convention that I'm doing. And that's what I always find very interesting is, I'll do huge conventions like New York or San Diego, but then I'll do, really, really, really small ones, or I'll do mid-sized ones. And it really it depends upon the time of year it is. It depends upon where it is. It completely varies. I can never predict it. And that's the thing I like about it, actually. It really is a mix. It's more than surf and turf. It's a total, cornucopia of possibilities.
Cornucopia of comic books. I guess it depends on if Amel's hanging around you, right? If he's just latching on to you or something.
I think it's usually the reverse.
I don't know about that. You're his boss. You were his boss. Give me a break. You were his boss. You were signing his paycheck.
But he's got he has such comic book convention game, man. I mean, he's invented conventions. It's pretty incredible.
But you tell him what to say and what to do. Come on. I know you're very modest. You're very modest. We all love Stephen Amell. He's awesome. We get it. But
I have to say, Stephen and I have always, we've always really said that it's a collaboration, that he and I are collaborating. And then that's really how I view it. And I will say, Stephen, to his credit, a lot of times has been like, dude, you want to pull the showrunner card, play the showrunner card. That is your right. You are entitled to do that. And, while I appreciate him recognizing that, it's never been necessary. It's always something where we just talk stuff out, and we will, talk it out and we will arrive at a solution. We've always managed to do this, is arrive at a solution that works for him and his interpretation of the character and works for the story that we're trying to tell. So I always prefer the whole, let's just work this out, as opposed to, no, I'm the boss and it's my way or the highway. Yeah. It is a collaboration. It's a collaborative medium,
He comes to the table with stuff though, right?
He really, I think, he really does. And he, it's fun a lot, probably some of the most fun I've had is whenever I come up to set, I'll be like, hey, this is what's in store for you. And we'll just sort of go back and forth. And a lot of times he has ideas. I'm like, oh my God, that's really funny. I was just about to pitch that to you. I will say his sense of the show and its direction is incredibly good. His ideas are very much in line with where the show has always wanted to move and where the writing staff has always wanted to take it. So that's really very, it's rare in a lead to not just be in sync with them, but for them to actually have a point of view to be in sync with.
Yeah. And he's lived with this character of Oliver Queen now for years, this version of Oliver Queen. It's not necessarily the comic book version, but it's his version, your version, Greg Berlanti's version. He's lived with this character. So I guess he's going to know it. You're a comic book guy. We've established that, you love you some comic books. When did that love of comic books begin? Do you remember the earliest memories of reading comic books?
I have an early memory of looking through a comic book. I couldn't even tell you that I was reading it because it was before I learned how to read. In fact, it's an incredibly vivid memory. I remember sitting on the floor of my room. I was flipping through a Superman comic, and my mother came in the room and she thought that her son was a savant. She's like, oh my God, you can read? And I was like, no, I'm just looking at the pictures. I can't even tell you where I got the comic book from, because I was the oldest, sibling in my family.
It's just you, right? At the time.
At the time, it was just me. So,
what did you get a Superman comic book? Oh, it must have been an uncle or grandparent or something,
I remember we had neighbors that lived directly across the street from us, these two brothers, and they had a huge comic book collection. And I remember getting a lot of my early comic books from them. So they're my leading suspect.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, I think my uncle, I remember early Iron Man, but I didn't buy them. And I think my uncle had bought them early on. And I think I kind of remember some of those. But yeah, it's the same thing. How did I get comic books? I don't remember buying comic books. I was four.
Exactly. So it's such a special thing. It's such a cherished memory of mine. Just those early days of reading comics and, really falling in love with the whole medium.
Did that translate itself into I like superhero TV shows? I like cartoons.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
When I was growing up, that was during the heyday, the golden age of Saturday morning cartoons, and Super Friends, just devouring Super Friends. And being so, you know, just so entranced with it. But also, I lived in New York, and there's a local station called WPIX, Channel 11.
Yeah.
And Channel 11, they were very smart. Around 3:30, 4 o'clock on every weekday, so timed to coincide with when kids were getting home from school, they would do an hour and a half block. It was the 1960s Batman show, The Adventures of Superman, mm-hmm. and The Lone Ranger. Mm. And I was in. I just was completely in. And then also the Shazam Isis Hour, also on Saturday mornings. Those three categories of content just so spoke to me. Also the $6 million Man, which, you know, technically not a superhero, but let's be honest, pretty much a superhero.
Oh, super. Considered superhero on this show, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that was kind of the, you know, $6 million Man was the first one-hour drama that I ever remember watching as a kid.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's, I think, all. I mean, you hit all the sweet spots. I mean, we're talking, you know, Shazam, Isis. We're talking, you know, Bionic Woman, Wonder Woman, all these different things that we grew up with. So it's, but again, it's so cool because you became that. You became the guy who made the comics and who made the TV shows. I love the fact that you.
It's so weird.
You were.
It's so great.
You loved it and you became it. We're going to talk about that. But before you did all that, you were a lawyer.
I can't reconcile these things.
I know. What made you go, okay, I'm gonna get into law? Like, did somebody inspire you? Did a guidance counselor or a family member? Like, how did you get into being a lawyer?
You know, it's funny. I'd always been interested in justice and fairness. Look, I mean, straight up, I got bullied a lot when I was growing up. And when you get bullied, you know, you become very interested in concepts of justice and fairness and redressing wrongs and whatnot. And I really wanted to not just be a lawyer, but I wanted to be a civil litigator. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to, you know, someone screwed you over, you go to court and you fix that. So that became really, you know, an equal passion of mine. To be honest, I was, you know, like I said, I was the oldest of three, siblings. And, you know, when you're the oldest, you know, you sort of tack towards the more responsible route. And even though I sort of had these artistic aspirations, I also, you know, wanted to be the responsible, good, you know, firstborn child. So it made it easy to choose between being, you know, a creative type versus the more responsible thing of being a lawyer, which I had an equal amount of passion for. It really was that sense of like, how do you help people right wrongs?
Yeah.
You know? And that
you're like Elliot Ness. You're like the
you know, I had a real strong sense of right wrong. You know what's gonna, you know what cures you of that really fast is practicing law. You know, practicing law will cure that faster than anything because the reality just slaps you upside the head.
Yeah.
You just, one of the reasons I got out of law for many, many reasons. I wasn't lacking for reasons to leave the profession, but one of them was this, you know, growing realization that all the reasons I got into law in the first place didn't really apply when you expose them to reality.
So that was a wake up call for you.
It really was. I was very disillusioned. I'll tell you. I mean, like, one of my last cases was I was representing this small not for profit profit hospital in northern Maine, and they got completely screwed over by this huge conglomerate, and this, you know, global, you know, company sort of crushed this small little not for profit hospital. I was like, this is the kind of case that I became a lawyer for in the first place. And we ended up settling out of court for, you know, a fraction of what my client's damages were. And the reason was simply they were outspending us. It had nothing to do with right and wrong or justice or fairness. It was who had the bigger war chest. And, you know, I was like, I didn't get into law for that, you know. It should be about who makes the best argument? Who had the facts on their side? Mm-hmm. But you didn't even get a chance to, you don't get a chance to make the argument or present the facts unless you can afford to litigate. And that is, it, you know, you're just burning through money. And that reality is a very sobering reality when you're confronted with it.
Boy, that played into some of your early screenplays too, I think, right?
Oh.
I mean, you did some, like, a lot. Well, we'll talk about that. Okay, so the transition you talk about, you're the eldest brother, but you have younger siblings. You've got two younger brothers?
I do. My brother Eric is also, they're both writers, actually.
One of them is showrunning Magnum PI right now, right?
He is showrunning Magnum PI 9 o'clock on Mondays on CBS. Please check it out.
I have. It's like I wanted to, full disclosure, I wanted to not like it.
Oh, well.
Because I'm a huge Tom Selleck fan, and I'm kind of like, oh, he's got all the toys to play with. Yeah, and he's got the theme.
It's so much fun. It's fun. Just so. And look, I mean, who's not a big Tom Selleck fan? Totally get that.
I know.
You know, but I understand. Like, it's, you know, even my parents are like, I love Tom Selleck. It's like, yes, but, you know.
Do they love him more than your
They're not
son.
Remaking this with Tom Selleck. So, you know, and by the way, Jay Hernandez is phenomenal.
He's just
phenomenal in a different way. That's actually the thing I really appreciate about what Eric and Peter Lenkoff did was they were like, look, we can't replicate Tom Selleck. So we're gonna get someone who is equally amazing, but just amazing in different ways and offers different things and different colors and, you know, a different take on the character.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's if I was in their shoes, that's what I would do.
Is he going to break the fourth wall?
I don't know, and even if I did know, I would probably not be allowed to say.
Okay, fair enough. Sorry, we digressed. I've been watching Magnum.
Yes, I, like the last thing I need, with Thanksgiving and spitting distance, is to like be like, you know, spoiling stuff on my brother's show.
Why did you go on this podcast and talk about him breaking the fourth wall? Okay, but he was the was it that brother or the other brother that got you into showbiz?
They kind of both did.
Okay.
Actually, I guess it was – I mean, they both did. Eric is the one who most directly got me in because Eric was in his senior year of film school at NYU when I was in my third year of law school. And Eric was the one who invited me to write a script with him. So he's the one responsible for, you know, giving me the bug. He exposed me to this this crazy side of the business. And it really took – I mean, I really – you know – I had never really done much creative writing, and I kind of did it as a lark with Eric, really as a chance to do something with my brother. And I was shocked by how much I enjoyed it. It really, really caught me off guard. And
do you remember what the script was? Was it Picket Fences? Oh, okay.
It was Picket Fences. So Picket Fences was a drama on CBS, same network as Magnum PI. Please check it out Monday nights at 9 o'clock. You know, it was created by David Kelly, who obviously, you know, has done a million things, including The Practice and Alec Beale and the showrunner of L.A. Law. And this was his first show post L.A. Law. So it had a big legal component to it. So but at the same time, it wasn't like just a straight up legal drama. It was like a family drama about a town. It was such a great show.
But your brother goes, I know a lawyer. I can get a little bit of insight here. So that was a nice in.
Yeah, we did an episode where this drunk driver hits a guy with his car and ends up injuring his one remaining kidney, the guy's one remaining kidney. So the guy, the victim, sues for the drunk driver's second kidney.
Mm.
Yeah, it was very – and by the way, if you knew Picket Fences, it wouldn't sound as weird as it does. The whole point of Picket was – it was an incredibly strange show. It was, you know, legal drama mixed with a little bit of Twin Peaks, mixed with a little bit of Northern Exposure. So, you know, when I say the log line out loud, you're like, what the hell? But that really gets
you writing in that sort of like breaking the mold kind of.
It did.
Writing
it was,
that you became famous for. Yeah.
It was great. You know, what's funny. We sent off the script to David Kelly's company. I forget what our connection was. And, you know, screenplays are like, you know, it's just a stack of papers that are three hole punched. And there are these paper fasteners, they're called brads, stuck in them to keep the pages together. Well, we got the script back with a lovely note that said, we are very sorry, we can't read this. We're not legally allowed to read it. Except here's the thing. It was all creased up around the brads as if it had been read. so we kind of
yeah, like
got
why
a,
would they right exactly why would they
we got a we really got a kick out of that. It was cool. It was a lot of fun. So we did two picket fences, and then we did a Law and Order, and then we wrote a feature, an action feature, and that was we did this 1 hour drama about the senior staff of the White House. And about a day or two after we finished our draft, they announced the West Wing pilot.
It's timing.
And it was like, okay, yeah, that's interesting. Thank you very much. It's like, oh, the producer of ER and the writer of The American President. Yeah, I don't think anyone's going to be reading the executive branch. Which
But it's funny because we'll get into this because that's really how Hollywood works. It's so much timing. It's so many different things. And what I want to find out about is a couple of projects that didn't make it, you know, like that one, but also how that springboarded you into something that did make it. Well, I guess a quick learning curve in the business at that point. How long after that did you work with Greg Berlanti, and then also sort of get into the comic book writing? I wanted to touch base with that.
It was a while. Basically, I'll zoom you to that period.
Yeah, because we have so much good comic booky stuff to get to. I know.
So basically, I was in my fifth year of practice when I quit, and I knew I wanted to work in television. And Eric and I had gotten a manager, and I knew about television staffing season. Anyway, quit my job, moved out here, wrote a sample West Wing. Ironically enough, that got me a job on The Practice by David Kelly, who created Picket Fences. So weird. Then I worked on Law and Order, and you know that was our third script. Wow. You know, at the end of my contract at Law and Order, I was talking about going back, but at the same time, 3 years on a show, unless you're going to go run the show, there's very little percentage in staying.
Right.
So I, you know, sent my agents out with a very, very, very narrow set of parameters in terms of the kind of show I would jump ship for. And that all those parameters were satisfied by a show called Jack and Bobby, which was created by Greg Berlanti and Vanessa Taylor and Brad Meltzer and Steve Cohen. And the pilot blew me away, and I met with Greg, and he blew me away because he's a very impressive gentleman, as you may have heard. Mm-hmm. And I got hired on Jack and Bobby. And it was while I was on Jack and Bobby that I wrote my first comic book. And it was really great, actually, because I got hired to do this 2-issue stint on Aquaman. And I'd been reading comic books literally my whole life. Like, you know, it was from the day I could read, I was reading comics.
Them. Yeah, you knew
them. I knew them. I knew the back and forwards and forwards. I had my outline, and I go to sit down to write it, and I got nothing. It's not that I don't know the story. I don't know how to tell the story. And I'm like, how is this possible? I know comic books. Like I realized I've never written sequentially before.
But it's
I've
a different beast, right? It's a different beast.
Completely different beast. Now, yeah. Thankfully, thank God, I am working down the hall from Brad Meltzer. So, who also, thank God, is not just a terrific writer, but a phenomenal human being. And he took me to school. He, you know, taught me how to write comics. Yeah. And that was amazing. And because had I not had Brad, I don't know what would happen, because I realized that reading comics is no substitute for knowing how to write comics. So it was a very interesting learning curve. But I wrote the 2 issues of Aquaman. They came out and they so set the world on fire that the phone never rang. No one emailed. Nothing happened for a year.
Good issues, but Aquaman's a tough sell, though. To be fair,
I guess Kurt Busiek actually wrote on like some message board, Newsarama message board, some incredibly, wonderfully complimentary stuff, and that was really, really nice. And I like those issues a lot. They just
but Aquaman's a tough sell.
They didn't turn into any work. So then my manager hooked me up with someone at Marvel who I sat down with over New York Comic Con. San Diego Comic Con. And he introduced me to Axel Alonso, who at the time was not the editor-in-chief of Marvel, but an editor. And I also knew Axel from his work at Vertigo and really held him in very high regard. And he hired me to do this Wolverine one-shot that this Punisher one-shot that led to Wolverine. And the Wolverine gig was the Civil War tie-in. Marvel was doing its first Civil War event. And he asked me to write a 5-part tie-in for Wolverine. And that is what put me on the map. And once I wrote that, the phone started ringing.
Yeah. Didn't David Goyer, was he involved at some point, Batman Begins, David Goyer?
Well, it's funny. David, in many ways, this is a little bit outside the box, but David was kind of responsible for the Aquaman.
Okay, so that was your initial. He got you in on the initial ground floor of that.
Well, yeah, what happened was my wife and I, we were engaged, and at our bridal shower, my wife used to work as David Goyer's assistant, and she hired her replacement when she left Goyer's company to be a writer. And her assistant was at the bridal shower, and her assistant was like, "I don't get it. Why don't you write comics?" And I said, "I would love to. It's just, do you have any idea how hard it is to break into comics? It's really hard. It's hard to break into Hollywood." And she's like, "Well, you know, David is working in comics now. He's writing Justice Society. Let me check with him and see if he'd be cool with reaching out to his editor." His editor at the time was Pete Tomasi, and you probably know Pete as becoming an A-list comic book writer himself. And Pete and I hit it off on the phone, and he ended up buying the Aquaman story for me. So in a very roundabout way, David Goyer was involved in my first comic book work, and then I worked with David on a show called Flash Forward back when I was at ABC.
Another one gone too soon. Yeah. Well, you led me into the family aspect of it again. You yes. mentioned the lovely and talented Tara Butters. Okay. You're at your office right now.
Yes. Yes.
You're not
I can.
At home. Okay. I was wondering if you could yell into the other room and ask your significant other. Look, she was amazing as a producer, showrunner on Agent Carter. Is there any way, like, you're in the house, like you can have conversations. If you could text her and just, is there any hope we can get of more Agent Carter? That's all I want to know.
I'm texting her right now.
And text her if she'll be on an upcoming episode of Comic Book Central too.
Okay.
Okay. We just want a little bit of hope, 'cause that's one of our favorite shows of all time. It's
I just text her. We'll see how well this works.
Okay, we'll see how well this works. Okay, so there's that. I want to talk about two projects before we get to Arrow. But and again, I hate to go back and talk about projects that didn't live up to expectations. But
those are
I think the
projects I like to talk about the most because, quite frankly, they're the majority. But
they build character. They build character. Two I want to ask, and the first one with Berlanti, No Ordinary Family.
Yeah.
You're a Fantastic Four fan, right?
I love Fantastic Four.
Okay. So if there is a team, like, I know you're not the showrunner on Arrow anymore. You're kind of open. So maybe you'll get in the Marvel Universe. Maybe you can do something with Fantastic Four, right?
Nothing would make me happier. Are you okay. kidding me?
All right. But you laid the groundwork on No Ordinary Family. How did that project come about? What did you want to do with that show?
Great question. Well, I'll tell you. It came about, Greg was developing the show with John Feldman. John Feldman's another writer who I knew John tangentially because John was showrunning Dirty Sexy Money, which was one of Greg's shows at the same time that I was working on Eli Stone. Also, John Feldman was one of the showrunners of Designated Survivor, my brother David's show, third season soon to be coming to Netflix. So anyway, it's all very incestuous.
You're just plugging everything. Feel free to plug. Yeah, I know. You're going to have to send me some DVDs or Blu-rays of these things too.
I will.
Okay.
So Greg, Greg and John were doing No Ordinary Family, and John had co-written another pilot that year. So basically John had two pilots that went into production. So I was under an overall at ABC. I had just gotten fired from Flash Forward. And so I had time on my hands. So Greg and John asked if I would executive produce the No Ordinary Family pilot so that John could go and executive produce his other pilot. So I did that, and that was a blast. I had so much fun working on it. That pilot experience was like one of the best experiences I've ever had. And the cast was amazing. And obviously, it was, you know, a subject matter that's so near and dear to my heart. There was a huge amount of, you know, references to the Fantastic Four. I got to work in a bust of Kitty Pryde, which actually I still have. It's in my home office. It was a blast. You know, Michael Chiklis, Julie Benz, an incredible, incredible cast. Wonderful, wonderful people. And then while I was doing the pilot, I got hired to write a couple of movies. And my agent called me up and said, listen, you know, if this thing goes to series, which looks like it's going to, you're not going to have time to show run this show. You're going to be, you know, writing these movies. Mm-hmm. So I scaled back my involvement to be a consultant on the show. So I can't really – I don't feel comfortable speaking to sort of what we intended or what we planned because, you know, once you're consulting, it becomes kind of not your bailiwick, or your purview to say these things. But it was so much fun, and I love the staff. I mean, worked with some incredible people like Ali Adler, who went on to co-create Supergirl. It's on Sunday nights at 8 o'clock. It's on the CW, and had a lot of fun.
But I think that would work better now that everything's a comic book TV show. I think it was ahead of its time, slightly, just a titch.
It was way ahead of its time. I will tell you this: we had the most competitive time slot. Mm-hmm. I think it was Wednesday nights at 8. It was the most competitive time slot that year, and we were actually, and as John Feldman liked to say, our lead-in was a spinning wheel. It was Wheel of Fortune. And yet, despite all that, we were actually the highest rated new drama of that season. And I will say the network didn't publicize that at all. They, you know, in many ways becoming a hit, it's not that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, but it's you can't just rely on the numbers. You've got to promote the numbers. You got to let people know that the show is safe to watch, you know, that it's not going to get canceled. And that message never made it out to the audience. And that competitive time slot, you know, became more and more competitive, and it kind of killed us a little bit. And the show really was ahead of its time. I think we were, you know, maybe a couple of years a little ahead of the curve, but a really, really fun show to work on. And I think, a very good show. I think I'm proud of the work that we did on that one.
Well, what's interesting, one of the things you mentioned was, you know, you were writing movies at the time. One of the second project I want to mention, too, is Green Lantern. The feature film Green Lantern. Look, full disclosure, I love this film.
Thank you.
I just
You're
watched
the
it
one.
Again. I am the one, yes. I got the Blu-ray. I watched it again the other night. My wife and I watched it again the other night. Can you tell me what we're missing?
I don't think we have that kind of time.
I'll tell you this.
I mean, I can answer it. I mean, you know, in all seriousness,
Do you like the film? You can be honest. I mean, if you don't like it,
I want to be honest. Do I like the film? No.
Okay.
I mean, I like certain aspects of the film.
Is it the film you wrote?
No, it's not. And this is sort of – this gets back to your first question, which is what was missing. Right. So when – you know, Michael Green and Greg and I wrote – we ended up doing like 5 drafts. And, you know, I think the last 2 drafts were really to, you know, make it producible because our first draft, which you can totally Google, and I always encourage people to do so because while it's the first draft and therefore a little rough, it still is a lot closer to our original intention and our original vision for the movie. That being said, when they, you know, I think Warner Brothers woke up to the fact that, you know, this huge budget, you know, tentpole movie was being written by 3 TV guys. They want to bring in, you know, what they call a closer. They wanted to bring in a feature guy to, you know, polish the script. Exactly. And I read that draft and I said to Greg that I said, okay, there's still a good movie in here. There's still a good movie, but I feel like the director has essentially doubled down on himself, because a lot of the work that we were doing in terms of providing heart and humor and just sort of an emotional weight to it had kind of been stripped out. But if the director, you know, directed the hell out of it and got amazing performances and really made some of these moments land, I think the movie could be really good. That, you know, he wasn't entirely successful in achieving those things.
I think it has that.
Well, that's great. Thank you. I mean, I'm really,
I watched it again and we got so hooked up in it, and the scene where his dad dies and the thing, and I love the Ryan Reynolds is perfectly cast and Blake Lively and the chemistry and.
Well, there's no chemistry between Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds. What are you talking about? There's no chemistry there at all. You know, it's fine. I'm really glad the movie produced a marriage, like, and a very long-standing success. That's great. You know, you know, look, I bear in mind, I haven't seen the movie in a long time. Obviously, you know, I tend to be someone who, you know, I do sign, I move on. Whether it's a success or not, I move on. And, you know, I think for me, it was wasted potential. Because the truth of the matter is that, you know, we were really building it, you know, to not just be a movie, but we were building it to be a franchise. And we got very excited about all the different places we could go and things we could do with it. And the fact that we didn't get a chance to tell those stories is, you know, a little disappointing.
How far along did you get with a sequel?
We wrote a treatment. It was a really cool treatment.
Any chance we could see like a comic book version of that, or like a?
That's a great question. What an awesome idea! No one's ever asked me that. In fact, I've never even thought about doing that.
I'll only take 10%.
You know, I'll tell you. You know what I would do? Sadly, we're not that far away from it. We're just a couple of years. Yes. I would pitch to DC for the 10th anniversary of Green Lantern. Not that anyone is bending over backwards to celebrate the 10th anniversary of Green Lantern, but I will. You know, I will pitch that to DC. I'll tell you a really quick, funny Green Lantern story.
Okay.
It's really my only one. So I went to the premiere. I get out of my limo, and the crowd just surrounds the whole theater. And the crowd is screaming, "Mark! Mark! Hey, Mark!" I'm like, oh, my God, this is so cool. Like, and I turn around, and the guy in the limo behind me is Mark Strong, who played Sinestro in the movie. And I was like, oh, that's right. That makes more sense.
Again, another wake-up call in Hollywood.
A lot of wake-up calls.
But I think I'm also looking at this back through time. I'm so glad to get to Arrow. But I'm looking at this through the prism of time and just going, you know what? I think they dropped the ball on Man of Steel. They definitely dropped the ball on Batman v Superman. Justice League, okay. But I think, you know, Joss Whedon had a lot to do with that. And I'm just like, why can't they just bring Ryan Reynolds in as Green Lantern and just do this thing right?
You know, I'll tell you.
Just bring him in. You guys have already laid the groundwork. I don't care that it didn't make a bajillion dollars. You've already laid the groundwork. Why does Warner Brothers feel a need to kind of like reboot these things or not use Amell as Green Arrow or not use Grant Gustin as the Flash in these movies? I mean, you got a foot in that world.
You know, I don't, though. That's the thing. I mean,
well, but you know people who know people, so.
Yeah, that's the thing. I know people who know people, but at the same time, I will say, like, the whole decision making process is so far removed from me. I don't even mean like that it's above my pay grade. I mean, like, I'm not part of those discussions, and even the people I know are not really part of those discussions. And to the extent they are, they're not talking. Okay. You know, so I really have no idea how the sausage gets made. You know, we don't even, you know, get free tickets. You know, they used to do like screenings for the movies before they came out. We don't even get that. Like, you know, have to go buy a ticket like everybody
cost
else.
Cutting.
So, I wish I could, you know, I wish I could say, I will say this. I've the Green Lantern experience, you know, and quite frankly, all my experience in Hollywood has really taught me that success, you know, to make a successful movie, creatively successful, I mean, commercially, it's incredibly hard. And the number of planets that have to align it's almost beyond calculating. And you really makes you appreciate when you do see a good movie, it's like a little miracle. I mean, the number of things working against anyone who makes a movie, the number of factors that are keeping it from being good, to overcome those factors, it's huge. It really is. And I give credit to everyone who succeeds, and I give credit to everyone who tries. Because the ones that succeed make it look easy. But the truth is, it's anything but. So I got a lot of sympathy for I have as much sympathy, quite frankly, for the people who do, you know, Justice League as the people who do Infinity War. And I know people will be like, oh, he picked a Marvel movie, but, you know, Wonder Woman, you know, like, yeah, you know, versus Justice League, like, right, you know, it's hard, you know, it's really hard.
No, I understand. It's just that Marvel seems to have a formula here, and I just wish DC could emulate it on some level, but they just keep
yeah,
the
same. I do,
and I know
way.
You don't want to bite the hand that feeds you, and I get no, all
it's
that, not but
even, it's not even that, because the truth is, I would, yeah, anyone's seen my other interviews, I bite all the time. It's more like the studios are one thing, but movies are not made by studios. They're made by filmmakers. Right. And it's those people that I don't want to criticize, because, like, I don't want to, like, criticize, you know, Zack Snyder, because, again, I know how much it takes to make these things. And I can't say that I would have done a better job if I was in Zack's shoes. So that's really, I'm just reluctant to, you know, quite frankly, badmouth the work of other creative types, because I know how much work is involved and I know how heartbreaking it is.
No, that's fair. Those are all fair points.
Get the result you wanted. You know?
I think it's the style of director, and I think you mentioned about on Green Lantern, Berlanti should have directed that. Campbell directed it. But I think it's the style of director, and I think the style of director that Zack Snyder is deep, dark, violent, and those things don't necessarily lend themselves to The Flash or Superman or things like that. So I think they, well, anyway, that's a whole other podcast to get into.
Something tells me a lot of people have filled up a lot of podcast hours.
Yeah, we have. We have a lot of free time on our hands. Look, in my opinion, Gustin should be on the big screen. Benoit should be on the big screen. ML should be on the big screen. But anyway, that gets us into Arrow. Okay, so initially the WB, the CW, it became the CW, but they're coming out of Smallville. I think they kind of wanted, correct me if I'm wrong, I think they kind of wanted like an Arrow type show or something, and then you guys came in but you had your own take on it, right? It wasn't necessarily like a Smallville take.
No, in fact, I don't even think they asked for a Smallville replacement. Basically what happened was this, which is Greg was originally, he had had a deal at Warner Brothers. That's back when we were doing Jack and Bobby, and he left and went to ABC, and I ended up going to ABC too. And then he left ABC and went back to Warner Brothers, and that was off of the whole Green Lantern No Ordinary Family experience. And when he went back to Warner Brothers, he said, there's another DC character that I have an idea for that I think would make for a really great TV show. So Warner Brothers never said, hey, we need a Smallville replacement, it was Greg who said, I've got a handle on this particular character that I think would work very well for television. That was Green Arrow. And then what happened was Greg had that meeting. Greg returned to Warner Brothers. Green Lantern came out. And Greg and I were both like, well, that's not an experience we want to ever go through again.
Okay, that's what I was alluding to. I stumbled through that clumsily, yeah. But that's what I was alluding to, is that you kind of had this 1-2 punch in 2011. I think it was within months of each other. And now Green Arrow, it's like, how did you rebound like that? Like, what was within you that made you both rebound so magnificently?
You know what? Honestly, thank you for putting it that way. I don't. First of all, at the time, I don't think we really thought of it as a rebound. I think it was, in many ways, first of all, I think it was Peter Roth's passion. Peter Roth was like, he wouldn't let us say no. Mm-hmm. He just simply wouldn't let us say no. So he got us really thinking about, well, okay, under what conditions will we do this? You know, what are the circumstances that need to exist for us to be comfortable? And what we realized was, where Green Lantern went afoul for us, was experientially, not creatively, was when we lost control of the movie. Particularly, you know, when Greg lost control of the movie. We had an amazing script. Greg was in previs on there was a sequence where what was the Hot Wheels sequence in Green Lantern was an air show, actually, in our draft. And Greg had previs that whole sequence, and it was spectacular. I still can remember every frame of it. It was magical. And long story short, Greg and I were like, listen, you know, if we're going to do this, we can't lose control of it. You know, we can't, you know, it's got to, you know, it can't become something different when you get a million studio notes or a million network notes. It's got to be true to, for whatever we write, good or bad, that's what we want to make. And we want to make it the best version of what we've written. So, you know, there's a whole, you know, amount of procedure that you go through when you're doing a network pilot. You do a story error and an outline, and there's pitches and notes and everything. And we circumvented all that. We just said, listen, we're going to come in. There's going to be one pitch meeting to the studio, another to the network. Then we're going to go off and we're going to write it. And we're not going to announce it. No one's going to know we're doing it. We're just at the end of this process, we will give you a script, and then you will either decide if you're making it or not making it. And we gave them the script. There was immediate interest from David Nutter, who is basically the Steven Spielberg of television pilots. Mm-hmm. And the moment David became involved, we realized, okay, we're going to be okay, because David, I've never met anyone who was such a fit for what he does. David, it's like David was grown in the lab to direct TV pilots. And he directs things other than TV pilots. He did the Red Wedding episode of Game of Thrones, for example. But like TV pilots, it's insane. It's like a baseball player who every single time he goes up to the plate, he hits a home run. Yeah. Every single time. It's unheard of. And the moment we got him, we realized we'd be okay. And then the moment we saw Steven audition for Oliver, who was literally the very first person who auditioned for any role, we knew we would be really okay. And it was just this, you know, it was just this process of at every stage, we're going to make sure that if we feel like the show should go left, we're going to keep it from going right. And there are always factors, you know, that are drawing it over to the wrong side. And you just keep sort of centering yourself and going back and being true to your vision. And, you know, having partners like Steven and David, you know, helped enormously. And it was lucky, but it was hard too. It was funny. The pilot, I would say, was fairly painless. Doing the series was really hard. That first season was tough.
The physicality of it, and then also telling two different timelines.
Two different timelines. The production value that David had given us on the pilot. Like, I remember us having a meeting after the pilot had been finished, but before the show had gotten picked up. Basically, the studio said, how are you going to achieve this on a week-to-week basis? And the funny thing is that if you go back and you look at the pilot now, I think it looks very small compared to the stuff we do right now.
Mm. It's huge now, yeah.
I mean, like, it's funny. I was just in the editing room today on the seventh episode of Arrow's seventh season, 707. And that is like – it's massive. It's just huge. So you know, part of it was the challenge of basically learning how to produce a show of this size. You know, we were really trying to do something that at the time had not been done on network television. And I still believe that the level of production value we were bringing to Arrow in those early years, you know, I think a lot of shows have caught up to us by this point, but we were doing something that no one else was doing. That was really, really hard. There was a lot of scrutiny on the project. Shooting in Vancouver for the first time, working with a brand new crew for the first time. They were new to us. They were very, you know, experienced on other shows, particularly like Smallville and The X-Files.
What were the challenges of shooting like the flashbacks and modern day, you know, present day at the same time? And then having to do that for 5 years, did you regret it at all, locking into that concept for 5 years?
I regret it all the time. I remember when we finished breaking the last flashback episode and like there was a celebration in the writer's room. What made it hard was from a writing and producing and casting perspective, it's basically like doing 1.5 shows. You know, you're doing the present day story is your one show, but the flashbacks becomes this whole other half because it has to have a different feel to it. You've got to have different actors playing the supporting roles. You've got to be in completely different locations. And it was hard for us just to figure out like how much flashback story are we telling each episode? There wasn't any sort of good template that we had to work from. So that was a challenge. It was, yeah, we didn't make it easy on ourselves.
When time travel was introduced in The Flash, you know, Greg spun the show off into The Flash. When time travel was introduced, the idea of metahumans was introduced there. That was such a huge departure from Arrow. How did that impact? Because you're in the trenches. You're running every day. Yep. It's believable. It's real. There's none of these crazy things. And then all of a sudden, everything gets introduced and timelines are thrown off. How did that impact what you were doing? And then also maybe from the acting perspective, what were the actors feeding back to you?
You know, it's a good question. All the actors were incredibly on board with things. I will say, you know, what's been really remarkable about the Arrow cast and Steven in particular is that they've always been so supportive of all the spinoff shows, and very supportive of the fact that, oh, okay, there's, you know, like, you know, you're the only child, you're the firstborn. Oh, there's another kid. There's another kid. you know, and everyone has, you know, been very, very supportive and terrific about that. When Greg, you know, said, hey, listen, we're basically introducing metahumans into this grounded world, I know my first reaction was, okay, let's figure out the way to make it work for Arrow in a way that doesn't upend the show. And that's why we had the whole Mirakuru storyline in season two. The whole reason we did Mirakuru was to introduce something, you know, off, you know, something slightly supernatural, slightly paranormal, to this otherwise very grounded world. You know, we didn't immediately dive in with superpowers, you know, people flying or turning invisible or, you know, or laser blasts. We were like, okay, it's going to be like basically like a super soldier serum, you know, some kind of super strength. We're going to ground it in as much fake science as possible, and we're going to introduce, you know, this meta concept, this metahuman concept in a small way, just to open the door a crack. And then once you've opened the door a crack, then in subsequent years you can open it up a little bit more and a little bit more, to the point where, like in season four, we were having Flash villains on the show, and people, you know, some people, you know, feel like that was the wrong choice. And, you know, I respect that. You know, I think there are some episodes in season four that were more successful than others. And then in season five, we brought the show back to its roots, not as a reaction to season four, but actually as a reaction to the fact that Supergirl was joining the CW. Mm-hmm. And once there were four superhero shows on the same network, all of us decided to sort of tack each show more towards its own core strengths so that they were all differentiated from each other. And so that means Legends went crazier and Flash, you know, really went hard into metahumans and science, and Supergirl went really hard into aliens, and Arrow went back to its grounded, you know, grounded, grim and gritty roots, because that's what made Arrow different from the other three shows.
You certainly haven't shied away from the Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams era of Batman. Bringing Ra's al Ghul in and, you know, shirtless superhero and fighting, you know, I mean, that's almost a lift from the comic book. But why not a Green Arrow, Green Lantern team up? Like, were you so fractured from your experience with Green Lantern?
No. DC. Like,
but wouldn't that seem DC. To be, wouldn't Arrow seem to lend itself to that?
You've dropped the clue in that
Hal Jordan's out there.
But that's as much as we've been, okay, you know, allowed to do thus far. I mean, here's the thing. These are not our characters. These are DC's characters. And they've been phenomenally generous.
Okay, you led me into it, because I talked to Manu Bennett a few weeks ago and about Slade and Deathstroke. And because the thing is, like, he's appeared in Justice League now.
Yep.
And he was like, Manu, he's an actor. He's like, I don't know why they can't both exist. And you mentioned, well, we're renting these characters, I guess. So, okay.
I was emailing with Manu just the other day about Deathstroke and about, you know, and I said to him, like, oh, I've got to actually reach out to DC and, you know, just find out what the current rules are, you know, because for a long time we couldn't do Deathstroke on Arrow. That's why Deathstroke basically disappeared for 2 years until we had him at the end of season five, because, you know, the marching orders were you can't have Deathstroke on the show. Okay, again, these are not our characters. We have to follow DC's lead. Then things changed. Their plans changed. It opened it up. You know, it's been a long 7 years, and there have been a lot of you know, twists and turns in that road. You know, so to answer your question specifically about like Green Lantern, you know, for the longest time it's been, no, there's other plans for Green Lantern. We don't want to merge Green Lantern and Green Arrow. We don't bring Green Lantern into the Arrowverse, what have you. That's, you know,
but you have Superman in the Arrowverse.
Yeah.
And you just tweeted out a picture of Superman.
I did. I don't know. I wasn't doing it. I didn't tweet it out.
You retweeted
it. I retweeted. but I made a joke about how we got the costume wrong. Yeah. But
this is for Elseworlds, the crossover.
For Elseworlds, which I think, by the way, is going to be. No one knows what we're doing yet. It's a different kind of story than I think a lot of people are expecting. And it's really come together nicely. They've been shooting for about a week now and I'm really, really excited. I saw a couple of things today in the editing rooms that literally like people are going to go nuts about. And what I love about this year's crossover is that it's, you know, in the last 2 years, it was you know, parallel Earth Nazis and it was alien invasion and really, you know, huge big stuff. And this year, for a variety of different reasons, we intentionally decided to go a bit smaller. But there's more. I think there's more. I can't believe they did this comic book fan, you know, wonderful stuff that than we've had in the previous 4 years combined.
I know we're short on time. I want to wrap up here. Well, look, I'm going to have you back on the show. We'll talk about Legends and tomorrow. I did talk to Brandon Routh. He said he would love to just if they could stay in one time period longer. My thought was they're always screwing up the timeline. What if they just stop traveling through time?
You're trying to kill us? There's no show then.
Trust me, that's though, because it's they're the ones screwing it up. But he said, I wish we could just stay in one place a little bit longer. That was his thought.
Okay, and just out of curiosity, did our line producer put him up to this? Because that sounds like the line producer. That sounds like Val Stefoff, who's actually, by the way, one of the best line producers I've ever worked with. And he never blinks. Like we throw in the craziest stuff, and he never blinks. But that sounds like a line producer.
I don't argue with Superman. I do not argue with Superman. That's yeah. I just make it a rule. What I do want to ask you is, you mentioned about the crossovers. Beth Schwartz is the new showrunner on Arrow. She says you're the showrunner of the crossovers. I think that's how she's described you.
She is very kind.
Okay,
she's
stepped down as showrunner on both shows, yes. Legends and Arrow. Can you tell us why you stepped down?
Oh yeah, 189 reasons. That's the total number of episodes that I had showrun between the two shows. I just got tired. I literally, like, between the two shows, it was 9 seasons, and I was kind of like just ready to try something new and do something different. Also, like specifically with the case of Arrow, I'm a very big believer that, you know, when a show goes past 5 seasons, it's kind of, I think it's incumbent upon the showrunner to step down, because on a network show where you're doing 22, in Arrow's case, 23 episodes a season, some new blood, some new ideas, make things fresh. That I think is important. And also, I had played just about all the cards I had to play. Certainly, you know, putting Oliver in prison and revealing his identity, those were two things I've wanted to do since the beginning of the show. And by the end of season 6, I got a chance to do them along with the million other things I've always wanted to do. And I, you know, was looking ahead to season 7 going, what do I have left to say? What do I have left to do that I haven't done yet? You know, nothing really was left on my bucket list, my Arrow bucket list. So, it seemed like the right time. And I love this. So this is like the best of both worlds for me, because I get a chance to, you know, still consult on the shows and work with Phil and Keto and Beth and, you know, keep a toe in the waters, which I love so much, and work with the people I love so much. But at the same time, I'm developing new shows, nothing in the Arrowverse, stuff in, but still some stuff in the genre space, working on a spec feature that's a historical legal drama, which is something with the exception of the legal part, so outside what I am typically known for doing.
But going back to your roots then.
Yeah, a little bit going back to my roots, but also it's weird. It's that project is fun because I'm going back to my roots, but I'm also completely stretching out into a brand new territory of historical drama. So that's, you know, it's fun stuff like that that I would never have the opportunity to do if I was still showrunning.
And how do we know more about that? Are you going to mention that on Twitter?
I generally don't mention that stuff. In fact, I'm violating a rule by even mentioning it now, but it just seemed like a good example of like what I'm talking about.
I think True Lies, you've got something come up with True Lies, right? The Arnold Schwarzenegger movie into a TV series, maybe, yes?
Last year, I wrote a pilot for Fox that I really, truly love. I really, really love it, and it did not go forward. So,
okay.
Unfortunately, that seems to be one of those, you know, failed projects that.
But it's cool that you're getting to do these other things, but you're keeping a toe in the water. And I love the fact that even though you killed Bronze Tiger in the comic book, the comic book era that you wrote, that I talked to Michael Jai White. And he's coming back as we speak, as we're recording this. We're minutes away from seeing what you guys did with him. So I love that you're on there. So for our benefit, it's possible that Green Lantern could show up on Arrow.
Here's the thing. I have to be careful because someone's going to quote me out of context and they're going to create this clickbait article that says Mark Guggenheim says Green Lantern to show up on Arrow.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I have learned, if I've learned nothing after over 6 years of doing these shows, I never say never. I never say something is impossible. And the reason is, if you remember during season one, I you know, me and Greg Berlanti, we said, you're never going to see superpowers on Arrow. There's never going to be time travel.
No flights, no tights. You
know, exactly. So I've learned never say never, because the great thing about having a show that's been on this long is all the stuff you predicted wasn't going to happen sometimes does. And I would never, you know, foreclose any possibility. Also don't know how long Arrow is going to run. So, I never, ever say never.
Have Ryan Reynolds on speed dial?
Ryan called me, man. Like, you know, we got stuff to talk about. But I tell you this, you've got me very intrigued by the whole, Green Lantern sequel, comic book idea. I love that idea.
I only take 10%. That's all I have.
Yeah,
and you haven't heard from Tara, correct?
You know, I haven't actually, you know.
We'll have her on the show. You can ask her to be on the show, and I can ask her myself.
I'm disappointed.
I'm sure she's quite busy right now. Twitter, you're out on Twitter. You're tweeting stuff. You're tweeting cool stuff. Superman in a black costume with the Flash and Arrow. Where are you at on Twitter?
M. Guggenheim.
That's where you're at. You're going to be all over the place. We're going to follow you everywhere. Mark, so looking forward to everything you've got coming up. I am about ready to just watch the season premiere of Arrow as we record this. So continued success. Looking forward to seeing you again at some point. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. We know what you're doing with the Elseworlds crossover now, Mr. Guggenheim. Oh my goodness, man. Mere days after we recorded that interview, Stephen Amell, Oliver Queen himself, the Green Arrow, he tweeted out pictures of himself as the Flash, Grant Gustin, who plays the Flash, as Green Arrow, Melissa Benoist, as her alter ego, Supergirl, and wait for it. Original 1990 Flash and friend of Comic Book Central, John Wesley Shipp, back in his 1990 Flash suit. That was amazing. That happened just days after we recorded this interview, so that's why I couldn't bring it up in there. Look, it's the moment we've all been waiting for. They've hinted at it. John played Henry Allen, you know, Barry Allen's dad on the show. He's Jay Garrick, you know, the Golden Age Flash. But, man, to have him back as the 1990 Flash, the show that started it all, man, it's something we've all been wanting to happen. We saw glimpses of it maybe, but we weren't sure it was going to happen. It is happening. It's going to be happening in the Elseworlds crossover this year. Mr. Guggenheim, you held out on me, sir. You held out on me in that interview. He hinted at some amazing stuff. That was part of what was going on. Look, I did check back in with Mark immediately after Amell posted that picture on social media. Here is what the consulting producer of Arrow had to say about
this December's crossover event, bringing Elseworlds to life. He says, in terms of commenting, I can just say that 1990 Flash is just one of the cool things we're doing in this year's crossover. Some are super subtle Easter eggs. Other things are, well, things you thought we'd never do. I'm excited for people to watch. We are excited to see it. I can't, look, if that's the stuff they're showing us, I can't imagine what they're not showing us, what they're not allowed to show us. So this is going to be epic. And stay tuned. I have a feeling something really, really amazing is going to happen. There's going to be a reference. And I just have a weird feeling, but I don't know why. Can't tell you why. but look, hey, oh, also, Mark did hear back from Tara after we wrapped that interview. He sent me a screenshot of the text where he said, I'm doing an interview. They want to know if there's any chance of more Agent Carter. And Tara's response, I wish. I don't know what that means. I wish we're, and maybe that'll happen. I don't know. Look, it's hope, right? It's some hope. She wants to do it. We all want it. Disney's starting a new streaming service next year. Look, could it go there? Will Agent Carter return? We all want it. Tara obviously wants it. I want Tara in the lair sitting down with me chatting about one of our favorite shows. So, it's all on the air. We're working on scheduling that interview for year six. It's coming up. Hopefully, we'll get to chat more about Agent Carter with Tara Butter. Stay tuned, Comic Book Central Nation. Hoping to bring that interview to you soon. My thanks to Mark Guggenheim for taking some time to talk to me, not only at Terrificon this summer, but for joining me on the show today. Links to his social media pages, you know where to find him. The show notes for this episode at comicbookcentral.net or blogtalkradio.com/comicbookcentral. All right, kids, that is it for today. Like an arrow straight and true, I am flying on out of here for now. But you know I'm not going to be gone for long. I am digging deep into the computers here at the lair. I'm pulling some clips from past episodes. I'm revisiting some of those amazing moments from the past year of the show. And I'm putting them together for you cats out there. Because next time on Comic Book Central, it is the 5th anniversary special. 5 years of the show. Man, where has the time gone? Memorable moments from the past year, your anniversary greetings and favorite moments, and I will be giving away that super 40th anniversary exclusive Comic Book Central Superman the Movie print from superstar artist John Pinto. That's going to happen on the very next episode. One of you out there is going to get to display that bad boy in your lair. That is going to happen November 10th. Remember, you have until November 5th to email me or record a voicemail. joe@comicbookcentral.net. Send those along. You can record a voicemail at my website, comicbookcentral.net. Until next time, keep your quiver well stocked with arrows. Keep reading those comics. And thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central. All of the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Every story has a beginning. Ours begins with a family that was ordinary.
Anybody who wants to ride?
Let's go.
It's right here.
We were all living under the same roof, but in different worlds. It's amazing how quickly life can change.
Something extraordinary has happened.
Something impossible.
You may be experiencing things that you don't even understand.
You two are freaky. On Tuesday, September 28th.
I have these abilities. I can finally make a difference.
One family will go from ordinary.
You're telepathic. I think this is something we should talk about.
To extraordinary.
I don't want new abilities. High school is hard enough as it is.
We're a family no matter what happens. Nothing's going to change that.
ABC's No Ordinary Family. Series premiere Tuesday, September 28th.
You turned my garage into...
That's right. A lamp. Wi-Fi.
On ABC.